And we can see that different elements in his philosophy and character could contribute to a combination of rumour-mongering and scandal that seems to have associated itself to Socrates. So his attempt to speak to a daimon, a personal spirit, could at one level be construed as a kind of attack on orthodox established religion, since it's not specifically Apollo or Zeus or any other god. And the fierce loyalty of his students, and one only has to read of the last days of Socrates, for example, the Phaedo, the dialogue set as he's in prison, as he discusses the nature of the soul while he is about to face death himself, one only has to read these to see how much he was loved by his students, by Critias and, of course, by Plato as well. And the fierce loyalty of these acolytes must have struck many as being vaguely cultish, as if there were something a little wrong with it. The aristocratic tendency, as we've seen also in earlier lectures, to indulge in pederasty, to have a homosexual relationship as part of the training of young men of the elite, might also have suggested to others that there was something vaguely distasteful and immoral about the Socratic circle as well. So we have in place, I think, at the end of the 5th century, as Socrates is reaching his middle age and old age, both a combination of philosophical trends and also personal trends and social circumstances that allow Socrates to appear to be something a little bit threatening, something a little bit suspect, perhaps something a little bit non-Athenian. And in fact, he's actually treated as a figure of caricature in Aristophanes' play The Clouds, as if he represents all of what is wrong with sophistry. At one stage, when he first appears, in fact, in the play, the person who's come to see him, Strepsiades, sees him hanging in a basket. And when Strepsiades says to him, "What are you doing up there?" he says, "I am mingling my brain with the ether." And this highfalutin, silly language of Socrates is meant to show that he's a character completely out of touch with reality. Now, this kind of harmless caricature of Socrates as a bit of a buffoon changes. And it changes because of the Peloponnesian War. The events at the end of the war, 404, change everything. After losing the Peloponnesian War, the Athenians are occupied by the Spartan army. The democracy is suspended. It is replaced by a pro-Spartan oligarchy made up of 30 men, simply called the 30. And here's the rub. At the centre of that oligarchic coup lay Critias, the uncle of Plato and one of the students and friends of Socrates. At one blow, Socrates no longer appears to be the harmless buffoon, the odd fellow who can be seen in the agora looking dishevelled, followed by a bunch of lazy layabout aristocrats. All of a sudden, he appears to be the mentor of a group of men who had been at the centre of a plot to disband the democracy. Now, after a short period of civil war between the Democrats, who withdrew from the city, and the 30, the oligarchy, after a brief period of civil war, the 30 were driven from power and the democracy was restored. The official policy of the democracy was to avoid vengeance, but there were many hard feelings still. And in Athens, Socrates was arrested, nominally on a charge of having corrupted the young and been guilty of impiety, for supposedly denying the gods, but really, in my opinion, for being the teacher of Critias, for being associated with the 30. Was he a martyr to philosophical freedom, as he's sometimes been presented? Well, yes and no. I think that we shouldn't underestimate the anxiety felt in Athens over sophistic education. And we should remember also that Socrates himself claimed a kind of intellectual and moral superiority, or at least his circle did. These conditions combine with a combative streak in Socrates' own character, which I think we have to pay attention to. For example, in 406, he alone had opposed the trial of the generals, being put on trial because, after the Battle of Arginusae, they had not saved the Athenian dead. Think of this combative feature of his nature. When he was called upon to defend himself, his defence was that Apollo himself had said that Socrates was the wisest man alive. Now, it may be that Apollo had claimed that on Socrates' behalf, but that claim by Socrates in the context of his trial was clearly inflammatory. At the hearing to decide what punishment he should be given, he said the punishment should be that he be given meals at public expense for the rest of his life. Again, this is inflammatory. It may be that we could see him as a martyr to intellectual freedom, but he was doing very little to make himself in any way more popular with the Athenians. And furthermore, he refused the opportunity to escape when it was given to him. So that we have to ask, I think, finally, what kind of moral courage is it that seeks its own martyrdom? At what point does prudence, in fact, become a real or as real a virtue as courage? I'm not sure I know the answer to that question. I think it's probably a question that only Socrates could answer.